From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, Milwaukee is one of the local sites for a potentially groundbreaking study of the development of adolescent minds.
Then contributor Gene Creighton highlights the important astronomy stories of the past year, including the discovery of gravitational waves.
For both the science and the science wherewithal that got us there, this is, I think everybody would argue, the most important astronomical event, maybe even in science, this year.
And later, why the Milwaukee Art Museum brought in an exhibit centering on German films from nearly 100 years ago.
When you look at these set drawings, these are not storyboard drawings. These are beautiful works of art in and of themselves, and they were done by artists who were working as German expressionist artists, many of them, not just film set designers.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. As most of us remember, adolescence is a big deal as you're going through it, but it is just recently that scientists are discovering just how big a deal it is in the development of us as human beings. And over the next decade, we will likely learn more than ever before about how young minds develop.
That's because work is starting on a groundbreaking study of the subject, the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development, or ABCD study. And Milwaukee is one of the local sites that will collect data. That effort is led by Dr. Krista Lisdahl, director of the UW-Milwaukee Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology Laboratory. She is with us in the studio to talk about what we stand to gain from this research. Welcome back to the show.
Well, it's great to be back.
Why is this study so important to a wide variety of people, not just researchers?
Oh, this is an incredibly exciting study. Some of my colleagues have called this the Manhattan Project for childhood and adolescent brain development, and I completely agree. It's going to be the gold standard. We're going to be following 10,000 kids across 21 different sites throughout the country, and we're going to be following them for 10 years. So they're going to start at ages about 9 and 10. We're going to follow them into the later teens. And this is just incredibly exciting. It's the biggest initiative by the NIH in our history, looking at childhood and adolescent brain development, where we get to look at things like how many different factors directly affect emotional, social, cognitive, and brain development during this period.
Well, and so let me ask, I think I have a sense, having one child who was just recently in the 9 to 10 range and one child who is about to be in that range.
Yeah.
I think I get why it's such a complex and interesting age. But why do researchers find adolescence such an intriguing time period?
Mm. You know, we used to think that not that much was going on during adolescence. When I was in undergraduate, they told us that IQ was set at age 12. Well, what we've discovered, there's incredible neuroplasticity going through adolescence, even into young adulthood, up to about age 25. And what's also coinciding is the onset of certain mental health problems, such as depression, schizophrenia, a lot of anxiety disorders increase. We also see interesting things to things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. We see the onset closer to age, you know, between 7 and 12, but we actually see that about half of those kids transition out of having ADHD symptoms in late adolescence, early adulthood. So we'd like to understand that trajectory better. We also see, with increased independence, a lot of changes in health behaviors. We see that sleep changes, stress affects the brain differently during adolescence than any other stage. We also see the onset of substance use and that might change brain development. And we really want to see how all of these factors at the same time impact emotional, cognitive, and brain development.
Well, and so is there just a wide gap in our knowledge of all these things as it pertains to adolescence?
Absolutely. So what we've done in the past is have smaller studies, you know, maybe 100 people followed for 2 or 3 years. And we've never really connected the childhood all the way into adolescence, into young adulthood period in one study. The other thing that's been missing is there's never been a sample size like this before with neuroimaging and genetics and all these other kind of biological assays. We're not just looking at, you know, 100 boys from one city. We're looking at 10,000 kids, about half boys, half girls, including kids of diverse ethnic backgrounds, education, and living environment backgrounds.
Is there a technology aspect to this? Is that one of the reasons that you can do this study now? Is it just not possible to do in this way up until this point?
Absolutely. So there's just been an explosion of technology related to magnetic resonance imaging and being able to share data across sites. And so we have several partners, including GE, which, you know, is here in Waukesha. They're really working on the study. Siemens and Philips scanners. So all of that industry is helping the study. And then we have a data and informatics center in San Diego at the University of California, San Diego, that is taking all of this data from all of the sites and harmonizing it and really using state-of-the-science methods in order to do this.
Did researchers have to get past the point where they weren't willing to share data? Because a lot of times, you know, we talk about, you know, intellectual property and people can be territorial about their expertise, their work.
Yeah, there's really been a revolution. And the National Institute of Health has made this a big priority to really increase collaboration across scientists. And it has taken a little bit of time, but there's really been a lot of studies like the Human Connectome Project, where we've gotten more used to releasing data and combining it and then analyzing it. And at this point, what's really exciting is that from the beginning of even the grant development and certainly throughout the entire development of the study, we've all been working together. And this is a fabulous team with incredible scientists involved.
Well, what is it about how the study is set up that puts it in a position to yield such good data? How do you ensure that you don't have all of these study sites and yet you're looking at essentially the same group of kids in 20 different cities?
Well, I think that's a good question. One of the things is that we have a survey company from the University of Michigan that is helping make sure that we have a very representative sample. So we're selecting schools in each region to really make sure we have a diverse group of kids that's representative of the United States. So we're looking at things like ethnicity, gender, SES, or social economic status, as well as rural versus urban. In other words, they're making sure that we're not just kind of picking the same homogenous group of kids. The other thing is that there's so many individual differences that with collecting 10,000 kids, if you wanted to look specifically, let's say, at African-American boys and what factors impact African-American boys over time and maybe African-American boys with ADHD and without ADHD, this is the only study you're going to be able to do that for. The other thing is we do have the data informatics team as well as the coordinating center at San Diego helping to make sure that all of the sites are following all the procedures and that the data can be harmonized and is reliable across the sites. And every single year, we're going to be releasing the data to the entire world. So we have partners in other countries excited about this data, and there's lots of different professors and scientists that are going to be analyzing this data that aren't necessarily on the research team.
And it strikes me that that's one of the other things that distinguishes this study from some other research studies is that the data is going to be released as it goes. We're not going to be waiting until everything is done and getting a big data dump, if you will.
No, it is going to be ongoing open access. There's going to be a little bit of a delay just to make sure that the data is appropriately released.
Sure.
And people do have to have some credentials to analyze the data. But I think that there are tons of scientists that are going to benefit from this.
Is there a moving target issue, if you will? I mean, given the long length of the study, is it possible that trends could shift between now and when the work concludes?
You mean like drug use trends or trends
exactly.
in different behaviors?
Or we might be looking at the use of certain kinds of devices, and 10 years from now, those devices are obsolete, you know, so we're not studying how cassette recorders are impacting our nation's youth.
Sure. That's a really good point. And of course, we'll be tracking it. So the scientific team meets consistently. There's different work groups, and we're staying on top of things like substance use trends, or there's a media device and kind of mobile assay, you know, work group that'll be tracking all of the electronics and what people use. And of course, the neuroimaging methods will probably change over time, but that's the data and informatics work group's job, is to make sure that we're staying on top of this over the whole decade.
Well, and so you're the principal investigator of this Milwaukee area study site. You're at the point in which you're recruiting participants in the Milwaukee area. How is that process playing out?
Along with our partners at the Medical College of Wisconsin Center for Imaging, we're going to be recruiting from certain schools in the Milwaukee area, and that includes going out, you know, to Waukesha and New Berlin and Menominee Falls and Shorewood, and so kind of north and south of Milwaukee and then going out west. And basically, the survey company will choose certain schools to make sure we're representative of the United States, and we will be contacting, or I will be contacting those schools, to see if they're willing to allow us to send flyers out to their kids and maybe an email blast. And then once we do that, it's the parents contact us directly. So I do want to emphasize that for the schools, this will not disrupt any classroom time. It will not have any cost or administrative burden to the schools. All the work will really be done by myself and my lab.
Essentially, the school's responsibility in this is really only, and not even a responsibility, but the only thing you're asking of the schools is to provide this vehicle to reach their families.
Exactly. To basically let my research assistants come out and put some flyers in the kid folders that get sent home with them every night. And maybe to do that two or three times during the school year.
What's the burden on the participants? What are the kinds of things that the kids will have to do to be a part of the study?
They'll have a very brief screening on the phone. It's very, very brief. And if they're eligible, they would be coming in once a year. Every 2 years, it would be a longer session, including a brain scan. But the brain scan is actually really fun for the kids because they play games in the scanner. And they get a picture of their brain, and the kids are really enjoying it. We kind of call it a brain camp. They also get rewards for trying hard, basically, throughout the day. And they can win extra cash for certain games. And they do get paid $75 for their time. The parents also get paid about $125, and we reimburse for their travel time. We provide meals and provide an iPad so they can watch Netflix. You know, we try and make it enjoyable for the family.
Well, and is there a role that the parents are playing in the survey data?
Sure. So we do interview the parents, of course, because we do need some mental health and physical health history of their family as well as their kid that's participating.
What won't the study do? As someone who studies adolescence, obviously it can't answer every question you have.
You know, I think that one of the things the study might not be able to answer as effectively is the effects of specific treatments for specific disorders. We'll be able to answer that to some extent, but it'll be a naturalistic study. We won't be doing any actual interventions for any disorders. So those types of questions will probably need to be answered outside of this study. Can I tell you some of the questions we can answer?
Yeah, for sure.
Because there's a lot of them.
I think we were sort of speaking around them before. So, yeah, talk about some of the specific things that you're hoping, especially as someone who studies this, to know by the time it's over.
Yeah, so some of the things, let me tell you, some of the areas that we'll be studying include sleep, physical activity, parenting styles, stress and trauma, poverty, substance use, sports injuries, mental health challenges such as ADHD, depression, anxiety, and how these factors might alter childhood and adolescent brain and cognitive development and how they kind of interact.
Why did you go into this field?
Well, I have been studying normal, healthy adolescent brain development for a while. I actually started studying the effects of drugs on the brain in adults and really felt like we were treating a disease very late in the stage and that people start using drugs and alcohol much younger in adolescence, some of my clients as young as 12. So I went down and started studying adolescence, and then I really just kind of fell in love with the adolescent brain. I mean, I think it's our last kind of golden opportunity to have the most optimal brain development. A lot of parents might back off during adolescence, and they should because there needs to be independence. But they also have to understand that adolescents need this scaffolding, and we need to understand, you know, what are some of the optimal health behaviors and parenting styles for adolescents so that they can be launched into young adulthood and early adulthood with the best mental health and brain health possible.
So at this stage of the study, as someone who studies this, it must be like looking forward to Christmas in a way.
Absolutely. It is. It's extremely exciting. It's like a kid in a candy shop. There's so many questions that we can look at. And, you know, I have to say—
You can probably study kids in candy shops.
Yeah, we can actually look at the effects of candy. We are looking at nutrition. And, you know, we can in the future start looking at things like the gut microbiome and other biological assays that we haven't even been thinking about. And me personally, it is just, it's so exciting to work with this diverse group of scientists. They're all over the country and they're just phenomenal.
And hopefully they're saying the same thing about working with
you.
Well,
I hope so.
Well, Crystal Lisdell, we are thrilled to have you here, and hopefully we can talk over the years as the data comes in.
Yes, I would love to do that and tell you what we've been learning about childhood and adolescent brain development.
Great. Thanks and good luck.
Thanks.
Crystal Lisdell is an associate professor of neuropsychology at UW-Milwaukee. She's also the director of the UWM Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology Laboratory.
She is the principal investigator for the local study site that's part of the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development, or ABCD, study. You can read more about that work at WUWM.com.
Coming up next on the show, the universe is billions of years old. Well, we'll focus on just one of those years, 2016 here on Earth, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. And this is the sound of Jupiter's auroras, recorded by NASA's Juno spacecraft. The spacecraft's mission is one of the highlights of the past year in astronomy and astrophysics.
Contributor Jean Creighton joins us now, as she does every month, and shares her perspective on some of those highlights. Hello, Jean. It is great to see you.
Hi, Bonnie. It's great to be here.
And this is our yearly wrap-up of all great things that happened in astronomy. Well, we can't talk about every single thing because we don't have enough time, but there were some big ones this year.
There were some big ones this
year. Amazing things. Like, let's start with gravitational waves.
Yes, let's. It was thrilling to be sitting at UWM and watching the press conference where the NSF person, the National Science Foundation person, stood up and said, "We discovered gravitational waves." It's like, wow.
You were there at that moment.
It was It was fantastic. So the significance of this, I mean, there are multiple aspects of this, but let's just talk about the science for starters. We found two black holes about 30 times heavier than the sun, who were about the distance of the width of Wisconsin, traveling approximately 60% of the speed of light toward each other, merge, making such a powerful event that for a fraction of a second, they produced more energy than all the stars in all the galaxies in the whole universe together.
Holy moly.
Yeah. That is such a powerful event that it sent ripples through space-time, which we call gravitational waves. Einstein, in fact, predicted these, a billion years later.
Unbelievable.
It is still unbelievable.
The scale is just astounding
to me. It is. So we need to remember what a magnificent astronomical, I mean, when we say here astronomical, it's just true. It's epic what event happened. Now, on the other hand, the other epicness is the vision that scientists at NSF had to pursue a very difficult technical achievement of measuring these gravitational waves, which, although they're monumental in size, the effect they have on matter is very small. So there had to be a lot of ingenuity, a lot of vision to support basic research.
Well, not only that, but just the fortitude to sit down and do years and years of combing through that data.
Well, the data itself wasn't years old. The events happened in fall of 2015, and people just had to crunch the data.
Okay, so I knew that there was a lot of work involved.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it's through years in preparation
for that.
Okay.
Okay.
Because this machine produces terabytes of data, I think, in a day. So you needed to be very clever about how are you going to analyze the data fast enough not only so that you can get your results in a remotely appropriate amount of time, but also so that if you saw something totally cool happening in this constellation over here, you could tell, you can notify as quickly as possible many other observatories around the world and say, how about you look over here and we can see what exactly is causing this. So for both the science and the science wherewithal that got us there, this is, I think everybody would argue, the most important astronomical event, maybe even in science, this year.
Okay, but we had some smaller, equally cool ones, just maybe not as epic in scope.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of Juno and Jupiter.
Yes. So Juno is a spacecraft that is orbiting around Jupiter. This is the eighth spacecraft that's visited Jupiter, and it has its main purpose is to understand the interior of Jupiter. And you might think, well, surely we know this, but it's actually a tricky measurement, a tricky analysis to make. So we're hoping to understand that, and we're hoping to understand a lot more about the aurora on Jupiter. I think a lot of people are surprised when they hear that other planets have aurora too. It's not just the Earth. And because the magnetic field of Jupiter is so incredibly strong, the aurora there are phenomenal. I mean, if you were to Google Hubble Space Telescope Jupiter aurora, you will find footage where we can photograph the aurora changing in real time with Hubble Space Telescope.
That's always so cool.
Yeah. In fact, one of the instruments on Juno was measuring radiation counts, and they transposed it into the audible portion of the spectrum so you can hear it. And it has this eerie sound. It's quite marvelous.
So we'll be getting more of that as time goes on, but this was a great year.
Yes.
So, for Juno.
I mean, I think the rule of thumb is if a spacecraft arrives someplace in July of 16, it probably takes at least 6 months for somebody to be able to say something really profound that's been edited and refereed and all these things reviewed. So I imagine that early next year, we'll be able to hear more about this.
Well, one of the other things that happens as we look back on the year is that not only do some things begin or get discovered or announced, but some things end too. And I'm thinking of Rosetta.
Indeed, Rosetta and also the Cassini spacecraft. They both have almost over 12 years now, and their mission is ending. Now, Rosetta was studying comets. And what's interesting about this, there's always surprises, aren't they? Remember, Rosetta was the spacecraft that sent Philae, that little lander, on the comet. We've expected that some of the water that's on Earth came from comets, because we know that comets are mostly made of water. But to our surprise, if you look at the isotopic abundance, if you look at the kind of flavors, if you will, of water on the comet compared to that on Earth, they don't match. So that would suggest that this comet, this kind of comet, isn't going to be the vehicle that brings water to Earth. So that's interesting. We don't know if this is, you know, a trend, if this is true of all comets. Of course, you can't say that from one data point, but it doesn't confirm our ideas about how water might have come to Earth.
And that's important, too, in the scientific process.
Oh, absolutely.
You need to know what isn't true as
absolutely.
Well as what is.
Absolutely. And as I said, one data point isn't necessarily closing, shutting us down, but it does make you pause. The Cassini spacecraft has been now for 14 years studying so carefully Saturn and its moons. And that's also being prepared to kind of shut down and have it, first plunge into Saturn and see as much as we can, And of course, we know that invariably that will end the mission. But hopefully we'll get some good data on the way down.
Yeah, exactly. It's always sad to see them end, but we also know that things are, you know, coming down the pike to either replace them or to look at other things. And so I know one of the things that happened this year was Pluto. Mm-hmm. We got some incredible pictures from Pluto.
We did, and that's thanks to the New Horizons mission, which flew by Pluto last July, so July of 15. They're interesting. So fewer impact craters. Do you remember the heart that we see on the pictures? The one side of the heart is quite different than the other. There are mechanisms for Pluto to erase some of its craters, and we're not quite sure why that is. I don't know if you remember, but if you look at some of the images, especially in the heart region, there are places that look like convection cells to me, which might not help our audience members. But imagine a hexagonal shape glued together like tiles. It looks like the surface of Pluto has these, almost like we're looking at the top of bubbles, which would suggest that there's some heat from within that churns the nitrogen ice. And we're not quite sure where this heat's coming from. It could be radioactive decay, but that's something still to be determined. We're looking at a possible liquid water ocean, perhaps under that ice, maybe some kind of ice volcano. So, you know, stay tuned. Pluto is obviously a place that, like every place, the more we know about them, the more intriguing they are.
And that leads me to kind of wrapping up today, thinking ahead, thinking of what's coming down the pike. We're going to a whole different star.
Well, that's the hope, right? That's the plan. First of all, we've discovered Proxima Centauri A, so that's the closest star system to the sun, to us, has a planet. And it's about 1.2 light years away. So in other words, light takes a little over a year to travel the distance between us. And it's very close. This planet is very close to its, let's say, parent star. So only 5% of the distance between the Earth and the sun.
That is very close.
So probably not the kind of place that we would be able to pack our bags and live. And yet, there have been plans announced in 2016 about getting, you know, a brain tank to see if we can find the technological wherewithal to send a very small ambassador, the size of a stamp. It would have to travel about 20% the speed of light. It would take on the order of 20 years to get to Alpha Centauri. And of course, you know, we wouldn't have people on this stamp. Obviously, this is just a machine. This is a pretty bold proposal, but I must confess, I don't want to burst any bubbles at this point. I love to think that we would start dreaming and putting together all the things that we would need to make that dream possible.
I just love the idea of this little stamp-sized machine traveling across the universe.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it's a marvelous thought to hold on to as we prepare to welcome the new year.
Well, Jean Creighton, I, as always, love to have you here. I am looking forward to our discussions in the new year. I'm sure there'll be plenty to talk about. We have never run out yet. but in the meantime, I wish you the best holidays and New Year celebrations, and we'll talk to you in January.
Thank you so much.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and a regular Lake Effect contributor. You can revisit her interviews from the past year at WUWM.com.
We will take another break now, and when we return, we'll take a trip through the world of German Expressionist films. It's currently on view at the Milwaukee Art Museum. You are listening to Lake Effect on WUWM.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Most people who consider themselves film buffs have seen or at least heard of the silent classic films Metropolis and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. But the German Expressionist movement that they were a part of has a much broader sweep than just those two titles.
From acting styles to scenic design, the German Expressionist film movement, which began after the First World War, influenced Hollywood in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And you can still see its influence in more recent films as well, movies like The Grifters and Mulholland Drive.
The original German Expressionist film movement is at the heart of a current exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Haunted Screens is on display through late January. And I met curator Margaret Andera at the exhibition, and she offered us an overview.
We brought this exhibition here because Milwaukee is a big film town, but also because the Milwaukee Art Museum has an extensive collection of German Expressionist art. Paintings, prints particularly, and our audience knows and appreciates that material very much. This is the filmic equivalent of German Expressionism.
So was the film at the time influenced by what the art was doing?
Absolutely. So this exhibition includes film clips from some of the most important films of the time, but also set drawings and photographs. And when you look at these set drawings, these are not storyboard drawings. These are beautiful works of art in and of themselves. And they were done by artists who were working as German Expressionist artists, many of them, not just film set designers. And so you'll see that Expressionist aesthetic in the set drawings particularly, and you'll see them then in the photographs of how the sets were built, and then finally you'll see it in the film clips themselves.
So before we get into some of the more specifics, set the stage for us. What was happening in Germany during the Weimar period that gave birth to this kind of expressionism?
It's a perfect storm when you think about it in terms of creativity. So it's right after World War I.
Which was a horror.
Horror, death, destruction. Germany lost a war, and economically, socially, politically, things had collapsed, essentially. And they were trying to kind of come out and find a foundation somewhere to build upon again. And so it was a desperate time in a lot of ways. And as a result of the war, they were cut off from Europe, even financially to a degree, but certainly culturally and socially. And that also means they were cut off from Hollywood during this time, too. So up to this point, there had been an exchange of ideas and films, and people knew Hollywood films, and Hollywood knew some German films. But now Germany was rather isolated. And what that meant, while the government was trying to rebuild, these film studios looked inward. So all of the films made during this period in Germany were not German Expressionist films, but a large number were. And they were not the same subject matter that Hollywood was producing at this time. They were not romance or adventure films. These were films that really reflected the mood of the country. The other important thing to note is that these film studios were often government subsidized at first. Some of the larger ones were. And the government was busy doing other things, and so there wasn't a lot of oversight. And so these filmmakers were making these incredibly intense, dramatic films, and combining with the German Expressionist movement that had already begun, there was a lot of emotion in these films, and they were pushing the boundaries. Just from an art standpoint, it was a moment where they pushed the boundaries. When you look at the way these sets look, they're not going for naturalism. The set designer isn't saying, okay, I'm going to make a living room that looks like every living room. No, when you look at the rooms that these films take place in, oftentimes the characters, the actors are scrunched down because they barely fit in the room, because it's this idea that the aesthetic becomes almost a character in the films. It conveys the mood of the film. And it's one of the first times that that happened in film history.
Were the filmmakers looking inward, like what happened during the war, why they got to that point, why they might have lost the war? Were they sort of soul-searching?
Soul-searching and also, reeling in a way. You'll notice the themes of some of the films that are included here are in this exhibition are, you know, the role of machines and that sort of, are machines going to take over, if you are familiar with the film Metropolis, for instance.
Is probably the one most people know from this period.
Right. Yeah. And Metropolis has another theme that comes through in a couple of other films included here, and that is, you know, in Metropolis, a human personality gets infused into a machine. The idea of being controlled by someone else. There's the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, where the hypnotist controls a human, a single person. So it's that idea of not being in control of oneself, of being in control of a larger power. So I'm certain that is absolutely the kind of feeling of, you know, having, you don't have your independent say in everything, government, society, whatever. You'll see the themes coming out. You'll notice, too, in a lot of the film clips and in a lot of the films in general, whenever there are masses of people congregating, it's either running away from something terrible or trying to prevent something terrible, or, you know, it's not a happy kind of walking on the street. You don't walk on the street in these films just to take a walk.
No, we're looking at one right now, walking on the street, and it's like in a snowstorm and he can't find his way, and
exactly.
And it's just it's obvious, and he's cold and he's not dressed well.
Right. And the street leads nowhere, or wherever it leads, I certainly wouldn't go there.
Yeah, and it's just so interesting. It was such a fertile time for the arts and literature after the First World War, because I think no one had seen that kind of devastation before.
Right, right. And so this is, I mean, that's what I meant by, you know, a perfect storm in terms of all of the elements lining up. Out of this desolation came one of the most fertile periods of creativity, and certainly in the film world. I mean, I challenge you to name a film today that doesn't have some sort of root in this period, and television shows, and, you know, you can see it everywhere. So I think it's just a really interesting, it's sort of how the human, they rallied, you know, after this destruction. It shows the capability of the human species.
And when you think it's 100 years ago, essentially.
It is. And the other thing I would say about the exhibition is that you can enjoy this exhibition on a number of levels, because if you are just a general film person, if you just enjoy watching movies, going to the cinema, contemporary cinema, you'll see elements in what we're showing in this exhibition. There are a lot of people, though, who are very interested in film, and they will enjoy things like the production process that you see when you see a set design get turned into a set, you know, how it was built on the set, turned into then the film clip. And some of the photographs that we have in this exhibition show behind the scenes. So, for instance, there's a scene in the film M where the murderer is being caught. And the scene where the police are chasing him is shot from a high, extremely high camera angle, so that he looks sort of like this little speck in this jungle of concrete, right? So there's that photograph. So you see the shot, and then next to it is a photograph that shows the scaffolding that they had to build to get that camera angle. And you also see the old cameras. We're standing in the introductory section of the exhibition right now, and you can see three cameras and a projector from the 1920s and 30s. And you can see these beautiful pieces of equipment. They're beautiful sculptures.
They really are. I mean, you look at them and you know they're functional, but they could be artwork just in and of themselves.
Yes, absolutely. And I've heard since the exhibition opened, I've taken a lot of people through the exhibition and given talks, and there is inevitably someone in the crowd who says, oh, I know that camera, that's a blah, 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 and I tried to buy one at auction. And so there's that level of interest in film as well that you'll see throughout this exhibition. And then also, I mean, the reason I first noticed the exhibition when I saw it, when it was shown in Los Angeles, was the drawings and the photographs. They're gorgeous works of art. They're gorgeous works of expressionist art. And to see the draftsmanship behind some of these drawings, to see how charcoal can look so ethereal. I mean, they're really wonderful works. The posters, the lithography that's included. There's something for everyone.
Well, let's look at some of the drawings that you particularly love, the photographs and drawings that you're talking about. So we're moving into the second part of the exhibition. There's some clips going on, and we've got photographs and drawings on the walls. So what are we looking at?
So the exhibition, after the introductory section, it's divided into five sections. They're all thematic. So this first section is devoted to nature. And we started the exhibition with this section because it's the least kind of expressionistic of all of the sections. Nature in these films and in the set drawings is still nature. It's sort of the Caspar David Friedrich romantic, 19th century romanticism nature that you'll see. But as we're looking at this screen right here, monsters live there. We're looking at a film clip from the film The Nibelungen, and there's a dragon. And so our hero is fighting a dragon in this particular film clip. So again, when I talk about special effects, people who are interested in special effects and the history of cinema will love this exhibition, because so that dragon that you see on screen, if you look right here to this drawing, there is a drawing that shows how that dragon was constructed. And it's a huge prop. Film prop, and it moved, and it had to interact with the actor. And so you'll see, if you look closely at this drawing, that there was actually a contraption inside which took four or five guys to move to make the dragon look lifelike. And so it's those sort of behind-the-scenes things that I think are really interesting.
Again, the word sophisticated comes to mind, because you look at that and you think, you know, there are things that were done much later that were less believable.
Right. I mean, if you think of the Godzilla films, you know, this dragon, I think, might be a little more sophisticated than some of the Godzillas.
So, yeah.
The other thing I like to talk to people about before they kind of go through and watch all of the film clips is to keep in mind that if you're not familiar with watching silent films, any silent film, people are always struck by the acting in silent films because it seems very exaggerated. But without sound, the actor's gestures are very much part of the narrative. And so they are exaggerated to begin with. But then, in this expressionist period, the actors were given the same direction as the set designers were. Extreme, make it extreme, make it extreme. So you'll look at how these actors move through these scenes, and you'll look at their makeup, and everything is, it's all part of the aesthetic. It's all part of this mood setting device in these films.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be quote-unquote realistic.
No, it's right. Not realistic. No, no.
Well, let's move through to another gallery.
Okay.
And we're getting to sound.
Most of the films are silent that are included, but a couple have sound. Later in the 20s and 30s, a couple of the films have sound. So this next section is devoted to interiors, inside architectural structures. And it's the section of the exhibition that really shows off the set design, I think, in a way that shows you what these directors were thinking, how they were trying to use the way that the camera captured an interior as a device to make you, the viewer, uncomfortable. There's tension conveyed in everything from the way a chair, like a lot of, if you look at in the drawings and in the film clips, a lot of the furniture, you wouldn't be able to sit in it. It's not really functional. It's made to look angular, and it's made to look extreme. So you'd question the functionality of most of what you see here. And this is also a part where I like to point out that we really embraced our inner German expressionists here at the museum in the exhibition design. So we built out walls so that a lot of the walls don't have perfect right angles, or in the interiors, you walk into these rooms, they're smaller, they're a little cramped. purposefully, and the headers are angled. The paint colors, the lines aren't always straight, and we have a bare bulb barely giving off light in some of these rooms. So again, the unexpected. We really enjoyed kind of making you in moments feel what it might have been like to be on a set. And the other thing that I really tried to do with the layout of this exhibition is every screen has nearby a drawing or a photograph that you can see a direct correlation once a clip comes up. So for instance, in this interiors room, to the left, we're looking at a drawing from the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And in a minute, you'll see the film clip where that set, exactly that set, which is a crazy drawing when you look at it. It's black and white angles and lines that it's an abstraction is what it is. I mean, these sets were abstract. They were pushing the limits of abstraction. And that's a set design. If you look at the window in that, it's this tiny little kind of trapezoid that wouldn't have been built that way. So that clip will come up in just a second as we stand here looking at it. Then to the right of the screen is a drawing, perhaps one of the most complex drawings in the exhibition, from the film M, which again is that film about this murderer who's on the loose and the police and the rest of the city and town are looking for him. And there's a moment where he's captured and he's brought down into this underground kind of cellar. And he is going to be judged by the people. So he walks down the stairs, and the actor is Peter Lorre. It's his breakout role, actually. And you see him come down the stairs, and then all of a sudden the camera is him. So you are now, you're seeing what he sees. So you're in the shoes of the murderer, right? And he looks, and there's this, it is an excruciatingly slow camera pan of all of these people ready to sit in judgment of him. It's such a slow camera pan that you actually have to look to make sure the people in the scene are moving, because it looks like it could just be a photograph, but it is actually a scene. And it pans across this group of people. That drawing is that camera pan. What you never see in the film is the whole group. You never see what that drawing depicts, which is the whole scene. So that drawing is essentially the drawing of a camera pan, which is, you know, where would you, you know, when do you even think about that?
Right.
And it's, again, beautifully rendered. The graphite is used to show lights and darks and, you know, again, just this reinforcement of this extreme aesthetic. I have a daughter who loves The Hunger Games, and, you know, she talks about dystopia. She loves that word. She learned the word. And I said to her, well, you know where that began. And she didn't. And so she is now learning about Metropolis and to know where things come from.
Right. And I think that's part of, well, to me, it's what makes culture so interesting, is where you find where things begin, where people have pulled influences from, and then hopefully develop something brand new, but then you can kind of look back and say, oh, that's where that came from.
Right.
And it's true in art, literature, music. It harkens back. You kind of hear echoes of things or see echoes of things.
And I think that's the thing that most people have come away from this exhibition. I've brought people through who have said, I don't know if I'm interested in old films. And I say, just walk through. And they'll say, oh, Alfred Hitchcock, he must have seen these films. Yes, they did. There's a scene in nature where from a film called Faust, where these birds fly across the screen. And I was giving a tour, and a child in the group said, that looks like the flying monkey scene in The Wizard of Oz. Yes, I mean, all of those things. You know, when I tell people, when you walk through and if you think you see the foundation of a film that you know, the answer is yes, you do. I mean, really, Tim Burton has gone on and on about how much he owes to this moment in film history. Martin Scorsese, you know, when you think about how The Godfather was just lit, you'll see it. Here's where it starts.
Margaret Andera is the adjunct curator of contemporary art at the Milwaukee Art Museum. The exhibit, Haunted Screens, German Cinema in the 1920s, is on display through January 22nd.
We will have one last break and then come back with some music to help us get into the holiday mood. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We are just 2 days from Christmas and its unusual confluence with the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah. Your calendar should either point out that the first day of Hanukkah falls on Christmas or that the first night is on Christmas Eve.
Well, either way, we'll get into the spirit of Christmas and the Festival of Lights this morning with some music from Milwaukee vibraphonist Mitch Shiner. We'll start with his version of Hanukkah, O Hanukkah. Milwaukee's Mitch Shiner with O Christmas Tree and Hanukkah, O Hanukkah. That is today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke. And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.